He reminded me yesterday that I had forgotten one argument. We had counted five arguments, no? Epistemological, dialectical, historical, quintessential metaphysical argument, and causal argument. One argument was missing. Anybody remembers it? Good, analogical argument. Good. Now, you have to find out for me in which paragraph analogical argument has been played. It is in the third paragraph. You have found it? Oh, good. Excellent. In the fourth paragraph, as there, so here. As there, so here. Twice that phrase comes, isn't it? As there, so here. As there, so here. Got it? So the analogy is that just as there, so here. Just as there, so here. That's the analogy. Now we come to the last paragraph. You know, I'm taking so much time with the first chapter because if you are well grounded in the first chapter, you become well grounded in the whole book. Because the first chapter is kind of a summary of the whole book. So if you know the first chapter very well, you can say to yourself that you know now the basic argument of the whole book. So I'm spending so much time, almost how many lectures you have given to them? Nearly 10 lectures, no, by now. It is worth doing it. So even this last paragraph, even if it takes time, don't worry. We shall go slowly. Thus the eternal paradox and eternal truth of a divine life in an animal body, an immortal aspiration or reality, inhabiting a mortal tenement, a single and universal consciousness, representing itself in limited minds and divided egos, a transcendent, indefinable, timeless and spaceless being, who alone renders time and space and cosmos possible, and in all these the higher truth realizable by the lower term, justify themselves to the deliberate reason as well as to the persistent instinct or intuition of man. It's a long sentence. We have to find out what exactly is the main verb in this. You can find out the verb, the main verb of this whole sentence. Good. Justify, this is the main word. Sri Aurobindo has made the full argument by now. And he now concludes. This is a concluding paragraph. Having employed all arguments, epistemological, historical, dialectical, quintessential metaphysical, causal, analogical, all arguments put together. Now, the conclusion is that something is justified. Namely, mankind's aspiration for God, life, freedom, immortality. This aspiration is justified rationally, intellectually. It is a matter which you can intellectually prove to yourself. It would be irrational not to accept this aspiration. It would be rational to accept this aspiration. And the main point is the lower term and the higher term. In fact, the very beginning of the argument starts with contradiction. What is low contradicts what is high. This is the basic contradiction. Now Sri Aurobindo has proved that instead of being in a state of contradiction, the lower is going to embody the higher. So there is basically no contradiction. The lower is able to embody the higher. This can happen only if there is no contradiction between the two. If the lower can receive the higher, it can be only if in the lower there is a possibility of absorbing the higher. And for absorbing you should have corresponding terms. In the lower there is normally the experience of pain. all our lower life as we are living, there is pain. In the higher there is bliss. Now if pain and bliss are really contradictory of each other, then the lower can never absorb the higher, if they are contradictory of each other. But if pain itself is a limited ananda, limited bliss, is itself a form of bliss, if pain itself is a form of bliss, not opposed to bliss, then you can convert this pain into bliss. This is the argument. Pleasure, for example, is in a sense opposed to bliss. Just as pain is opposed to bliss, similarly pleasure also is opposed to bliss. Because the pleasure that we have is a kind of an ephemeral, flimsy kind of a sensation, which happens for a little while and then goes away. And that pleasure has nothing comparable to that bliss. Therefore even pleasure is opposed to that bliss. But if pleasure also is only a limited bliss, then in that limited thing, when it expands, it becomes bliss. So what was seen to be contradictory is not really contradictory. It is simply a limited form of the higher. Therefore it is an eternal paradox. Paradox because how can bliss become pain? How can bliss become pleasure? How can bliss become indifference? Because these are the only three experiences we have. Indifference, pleasure and pain. So how can these three, which are seemingly opposite of bliss, how can these three be turned into bliss? They can be turned into bliss because they are limited forms. When you limit ananda, and then that limitation takes these three forms, pleasure, pain, indifference. In fact, there is a full chapter, chapter number 12 in this book, where Sri Aurobindo will explain how ananda, the bliss, has become pleasure, pain and indifference by limitation. So they are not contradictory of each other, they are only paradoxical of each other. You know, there is a difference between opposition and paradox. A paradox is where two opposites seem to be apparently opposite, but not really. I am hastening slowly. If I speak this sentence, I am hastening slowly. It's a paradox. Charmingly ugly. There are experiences, experience of ugliness, but very charming. Charmingly ugly. It's paradox, but not really paradox, because in ugliness also there is a charm. I am tragically happy. I am tragically happy. It's a paradox. A tragedy occurs and you feel happy. Tragedy normally creates a lot of sorrow, but there are experiences where you become tragically happy. There was an experience. If you see the drama called Hamlet, I don't know if you know the story of Hamlet, do you? You know the story of Hamlet? If you see the drama of Hamlet, the story as it unfolds before you, if you are somebody staging the whole drama of Hamlet, the story begins with a dreadful night. Already the scene, the very first scene of Hamlet, gives you a kind of an atmosphere of dread. Everything is hush, not a mouse stirring. And then there appears the ghost of the father of Hamlet, who has just died. So the whole atmosphere is full of suspense. Something weird, something strange, dreadful. In something that is dark, a ghost appearing and calling Hamlet alone. He wants to communicate a message. Hamlet is drawn, and then the ghost reveals to Hamlet that he has been murdered. It's not an ordinary death. And that murder was committed by his brother and his wife. That is, his own wife and his own brother. A dreadful story. This is the starting point of the tragedy. Something horrible has happened, And now there is unfoldment of horrible events, one after the other. And if you examine the play, it's a series of murders which take place, one after the other. A series of deaths which occur. Polonius is murdered, Ophelia died, and then several others. And towards the end, Laertes, the brother of Ophelia, is murdered. The king is murdered. The wife dies. Horatio is murdered. Hamlet goes. Full of tragedy. When you see at the end, you feel comforted. Whole horrible thing has ended. Tragically happened. There is a release, as it were. Hamlet, who was tortured, there is an end in which you feel the release of Hamlet from all kind of torture. It's an experience of tragic happiness. So whenever there is a real tragedy from another side, there is an angle of looking at every tragedy where you find a release. It gives its own experience. So there is not exact opposition between tragedy and happiness. It's a paradox. Similarly, experience of pain, experience of pleasure and experience of indifference, through which we pass all the time. If you examine your life, you will find that 3/4 of our life we are indifferent. We are insensitive. If you examine the hours of sleep that we have, those hours of sleep are actually hours of indifference, basically. Except when you're nightmare. That's another matter. A little time that you have is of pleasure, and the rest of the time you have kind of suffering. These are the 3 experiences that we have. But the real bliss, which is constantly present, of which we are not aware, which is not abolished any time, it is there always. It's not as if this pain or pleasure or indifference is able to abolish that bliss. We are not aware of it. There is a constant stream of bliss. It is constantly flowing. Only we don't experience it because of limitation. If pleasure, pain and indifference are able to abolish bliss, it will be opposite. But they are not real opposites. The pain does not abolish the inner bliss. This is the theme of the chapter number 12 of the Life Divine. If you see chapter number 12, what's the title of the chapter? Chapter number 12. That's a delight of existence, dissolution. Chapter number 11 also is entitled Delight of Existence, but the problem. And then I would like you to read 4 lines which have been quoted by Sri Aurobindo from an Upanishad called Taittiriya Upanishad. In that Upanishad, these words come. For who could live or breathe if there were not this delight of existence as the ether in which we dwell? If we are existing, even in the most deplorable condition, it is because there is a breath all the time hanging over us, breath of delight. For who could live or breathe if there were not this delight of existence as the ether in which we dwell? From delight all these things are born. By delight they exist and grow. To delight they return. This is one of the most memorable statements in world history. It tells you, in whatever condition you are, you remember, at the depth of your being, there is this delight always, always available. Never feel that your present condition of indifference or pleasure or pain is going to last. You just make an effort, go deep in you, and you'll find this. Where today there is pain, suffering, indifference, pleasure, there can take place the breathing of delight. Because of this reason, the lower does not cancel the higher. The lower is able to manifest the higher. Therefore it is paradox, but not contradictory. This is the real solution that Sri Aurobindo presents. What is contradictory is not really contradictory. It is only a paradox. And paradox can always be resolved into harmony. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo says the eternal truth and eternal paradox. It's a paradox forever because even when you attain to delight, you can always turn it into pain if you want to. It's not impossible. You limit yourself, it will become pain. You limit yourself in another way, it will become pleasure. You limit yourself in another third way, it will become indifference. So let us read now. Thus the eternal paradox and eternal truth of a divine life in an animal body, an immortal aspiration or reality, inhabiting a mortal tenement. Our body is mortal. But in that mortal body, there is an undying aspiration, immortal aspiration. And also in that mortal body, the immortal reality exists. A single and universal consciousness, representing itself in limited minds and divided egos. This is also paradox. Universal and transcendent consciousness on the one hand, and divided ego in our present consciousness. The two existing side by side, as it. Not cancelling, but capable of existing side by side. Therefore, not contradiction, only paradox. A transcendent, indefinable, timeless, and spaceless being is on one side, who alone renders time and space and cosmos possible. In all these, the higher truth realizable by the lower term, all this is justified. They justify themselves to the deliberate reason. Mark the word deliberate reason. We had come across the word deliberate earlier also. As I told you, deliberate reason or deliberate way of thinking is quintessential metaphysical. The real metaphysical reasoning is deliberate reason. Not only reason, but deliberate. The reason which seeks for meaning, that is called deliberate reason. The reason which seeks for meaning and ultimately finds it. Finding is the satisfaction of deliberate reason. It's the fulfillment of deliberate. But the seeking is the driving force. Seeking for meaning is a driving force. And ultimately the driving force is fulfilled when the meaning is found. So Sri Aurobindo had asked this question in the beginning, that the contradiction which is found between material existence and the ideals of God, right, and freedom and mortality, this contradiction, if you examine by deliberate reason, don't jump to the conclusion that it's a contradiction. Ask yourself, is it really a contradiction? Is there a meaning in this contradiction? Is it a meaningful contradiction? If you ask this question, then you find an answer which is expounded in third paragraph and fourth paragraph. In the fifth paragraph, now you have found the answer. And therefore we say that this contradiction is really a paradox. And this paradox justifies itself to our deliberate reason, to the reason which has sought for meaning. There is a meaning in it. Now Sri Aurobindo adds two more words. Justify themselves to the deliberate reason, as also to the persistent instinct or intuition of mankind. There are now three words which are important from philosophical point of view. Deliberate reason, instinct, and intuition. Deliberate reason we have experienced now quite thoroughly during these last 10 lectures or more. Deliberate reason is driven by the search for meaning, and that reason utilizes various kinds of arguments, which you have seen so many kinds of arguments. This entire exercise is the exercise of deliberate reason. Epistemological argument, dialectical argument, analogical argument, historical argument, all these arguments have been utilized by the deliberate reason. Having used all these arguments, our reason is now satisfied. We have found the meaning. We have found they are not opposites. There is no contradiction. It's only a paradox. And therefore, it is justified. It has a meaning in it, significance in it. Now Sri Aurobindo says that what is justified from the rational point of view is also justified by the instinct. What is instinct? What is the difference between instinct and reason? That's why. In instinct there is immediacy. In reason there is a process. You have facts, you derive from the facts conclusions. So there is a process. It's almost like blind. Blindly you try to judge this, judge that, then you compare and then you arrive at a picture in your mind. In the instinct, just touch and you know, even more than that. All experience of pain is instinctive. Not only experience of pain, but all experience of pain is immediately accompanied by rejection. Automatic. There is no process. You don't say, now let me see, the pain has come, let me receive it. As soon as there is pain, there is rejection. Automatic. So this instinctive rejection of pain indicates something. Why do we instinctively reject pain? Because it has already known what is happiness. This pain is found to be opposite to it. If you did not know what is happiness, you would never reject pain. There is ether of happiness in your being all the time. You may not be conscious of it, but it is there already. So when something contrary happens, you immediately reject it. Oh no, this is not me. It can't belong to me. I do not want it. It cannot be. You instinctively receive it. Instinctively. Both are instinctive.
No, in the sense that you said that there is this ether of happiness which is as opposed to pain. So it is also opposed to pleasure too. So why don't we instinctively reject pleasure?
Rejection is not the only way in which you instinctively see whether it is immediate or not. The question is of instinctiveness, the immediacy. As soon as you feel pleasure, you instinctively receive it. Immediately, there is no process. There is immediate acceptance of it. Now the deeper question that you ask is the main theme of these two chapters. Delight of existence, the problem, and delight of existence, the solution. So we shall deal with it at length. My immediate answer is only this. At present we are only considering what is instinctive. In both the cases there is no process. There is instinctive, immediate reaction. You eat something bitter and immediately you want to throw it away. Instinctively. You eat anything that is sweet and immediately you like it. Instinctively. You know, there are other states of consciousness where you ask the question about pleasure. In a certain state of consciousness, what we call pleasure is immediately rejected. There are states of consciousness. There is a very interesting case of Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda. Swami Vivekananda was a good student. He loved his teacher very well, but he never took for granted whatever he said. He was a good student. So once he wanted to test his teacher. He wanted to examine his teacher. So one day he put some money under the cover of the seat where Ramakrishna used to sit. And Ramakrishna came to the seat. As he touched it, immediately threw it away. The presence of coins of money, which normally people like to have, in his case, as soon as he touched, he immediately stood up and as if there was a snake in it, threw it away immediately. So it depends upon your state. But both are instinctive. So there are pleasures at a certain stage of your consciousness. Actually, Mother has said that if you succeed very quickly, be doubtful. If you go on succeeding very quickly, then think there is a trap for you. So don't feel so happy about it. So one who is very wise, as soon as he succeeds, he feels, my Lord, something is wrong. How could I succeed? There is something wrong about it. Indifference, for example, we are always in that state automatically in the sense of indifference. But once you have enjoyed that bliss, you can never tolerate indifference. You can't remain in the state of indifference. You will reject it. You can't remain indifferent. It's a question of what is your balance in your totality of your being. Our present rejection of pain, of our present acceptance of pleasure instinctively, is due to the present balance of our consciousness. There are states of consciousness in which bitter medicines are enjoyed. You enjoy bitterness and you don't like pleasure, the sweetness. There are states of consciousness in which what is pleasant to you is not liked. See, it all depends upon, as Sri Aurobindo says, a question of habit. Our present balance of consciousness is such that habitually we reject pain, habitually we receive pleasure. But you can change that. The thing regarding which you are frightened about, when you look back, you feel it was so good that a frightening thing happened to you. Somebody knocks your door, you are sleeping at that time, and you feel this bother, somebody coming and knocking, wakes you up. You don't like his coming at all. And you open the door, and lo and behold, that you were looking for the last 10 years is standing before you. That dreadful experience, that experience of pain, is immediately turned into a tremendous delight. It's only a question of your consciousness, your state of consciousness. So if you know that in every experience it is only God who knocks your door at any time, then you will never be frightened about anything. Normally we are frightened because we feel some strange thing has happened for which you are not ready and disturbs your present condition of consciousness. But when you look backward, you find that was a tremendously good thing to happen. So if you know that every time, in every circumstance, it is God who is around you, then even the one who is opposing you all the time is felt to be your great friend. That's why Sri Aurobindo said, "Who is my enemy? Oh, the one who took me to the embrace of my Lord." One whom you think is your enemy is actually the very one who takes you to the embrace of the Lord. So who is your enemy? That is how our pain is transformed into delight. Therefore, pain is not opposed to the delight. It is only your present state of consciousness which is limited. You break down the limitation, then the delight which is automatic everywhere will be experienced in all the circumstances. It's called the real art of life. The real art of life arises from a philosophy which concludes that divine is everywhere. Now you apply that proposition in real terms and you find in every circumstance it is a divine. Therefore delight will be all the time your accompaniment. We have to only discover where is the divine. In the horrible face you see the beauty. The dreadful thing is the most delightful. The dread is only a mask. Mask is to be uncovered. So eternal paradox and eternal truth, they justify themselves when you realize that the lower term is capable of embodying the higher term. Now instinctively, Sri Aurobindo says that this proposition is accepted even by instinct. Instinctively, we love the life. Instinctively. The eyes can flourish only in light. If you remain all the time in darkness, eyes will become blind in due course. They flourish only in light. There is instinctive movement towards light. So, God, life, freedom, immortality is justified not only by deliberate reason, but also by instinct. Instinctively you want delight. Therefore you reject pain. Instinctively you will reject pleasure, because pleasure is a great blockade to the delight. Only we don't know now, but actually speaking, all pleasures are a blockade to the delight. They imprison you in a small pleasure for a little while. Therefore, if you learn afterwards, you'll automatically reject pleasure, because you have instinctive movement towards happiness, towards delight. Inalienable delight, inexhaustible delight, imperishable delight. You know, there was an experience of Sri Aurobindo. Sri Aurobindo was placed in the jail in 1908 by the Britishers. Now, if you look at the jail, Sri Aurobindo himself has described the cell in which he was living. You imagine hot summer, because he was taken to the jail in the month of May, 1908 in the month of May in Calcutta. Now, in that cell was a very small cell, perhaps of the size from here, only perhaps a little room where hardly he can sleep. There was one bowl given to him and one blanket. This is all that he was gifted by the Britishers. He lived in that cell for 1 year. Sri Aurobindo has humorously described the bowl. What kind of bowl it was? He said he was like a bureaucrat. A bowl was like a bureaucrat. A bureaucrat can be used for all kinds of functions. In India, a bureaucrat can be in charge of law and order. He can be in charge of railways. he can be in charge of accounts, he can be in charge of justice, he can be in charge of postage. Wherever you put him, a bureaucrat is able to do any activity that is assigned to him. So Sri Aurobindo said that this bowl was used for drinking water. It was also used, the same bowl had to be used also for eating the food or your dal, whatever was given to him. It was also used for evacuation, the same bowl, the same for urination, for everything. It was like a bureaucrat, he says, this particular bowl. Then he says that this particular room had no pavement at all. It was simply a kind of soil, ground. There was no flooring. And under heat, red ants used to come out. When there was tremendous heat, red ants used to come out of the ground. Now how would you avoid the red ants? You have only a room which you cannot leave. There is tremendous heat. The only cloth piece you have got is a blanket which was also hot. And red ants were coming out. The only result would be that you will be bitten by the red ant. And red ants were biting Sri Aurobindo. This was the time when he realized Sri Krishna all around him. He himself has written that all around I saw only Sri Krishna smiling. Tremendous delight. Not only delight to the eyes, but he said even the ants which are biting were experiences of joy. He transformed these terrible bites into delight. When Sri Aurobindo fell in 1938 in his room here in the ashram Pondicherry, and he broke the thigh bone. Normally it produces tremendous pain, but that pain was turned by Sri Aurobindo to great delight. Now these are facts, not thought out, not merely thinking pain becoming pleasure or happiness, not that. You can really turn it into that. Now these possibilities Sri Aurobindo has seen, experienced. Therefore Sri Aurobindo has written all this. These are not speculations. They are based upon direct experiences. What is pleasant can become painful. What is painful can become pleasant. What is temporarily pleasant can become delight forever. These are the possibilities of our consciousness. Therefore paradox, not the contradiction. We can turn them into the opposites. So, this whole argument that we studied from the point of deliberate reason. Now Sri Aurobindo says, instinctively also it is the same conclusion. Intuitively also, now it comes intuition. What is intuition? Instinct and intuition are both similar to each other, excepting in one character. Instinct is immediate. Intuition also is immediate. But instinct is predominantly active. All instincts manifest themselves into action. Intuition is predominantly self-conscious, luminous. All intuitions are self-aware. Instincts are not self-aware. They are not aware of themselves. There is some awareness, but very slight. Mostly it is action. When I am hungry, there is instinct to eat. So when there is a hunger, your instinct takes you immediately to eat. There is a movement towards eating, activity of eating. Manifests itself into activity of eating. Very often you are not even aware that you are hungry. And yet when you get the food, you immediately want to eat it. Children don't know that they are hungry. They cry. When they cry, they don't know it is because of appetite or hunger. They simply are looking for food. Therefore, as soon as the food is given, immediately there is silence. All cry goes away. It's instinctive. Instinctive is primarily active, only secondarily luminous. Intuition is primarily luminous, secondarily active. That's the only difference between instinct and intuition. If you open chapter number 8, page number 65, the instinct is subconscious. Intuition is superconscious. Now, if you read the 7th line, 1, 2, 9th line, from the top, page number 65, paragraph which begins with, but always mental experience, the master word of the subconscious, the master word of the superconscious is light. Have you got that sentence? Yes? The master word of the subconscious is light. The master word of the subconscious is life. The master word of the superconscious is light. Now read further. In the subconscious, knowledge or consciousness is involved in action. So action is predominant. In the superconscious, action re-enters into life and no longer contains involved knowledge, but is itself contained in a supreme consciousness. Intuitional knowledge is that which is common between them. And the foundation of intuitional knowledge is conscious or effective identity between that which knows and that which is known. It is that state of common self-existence in which the knower and the known are one through knowledge. But in the subconscious, the intuition manifests itself in the action, in effectivity. And the knowledge of conscious identity is either entirely or more or less conceived in the action. In the superconscious, on the contrary, light being the law and the principle, the intuition manifests itself in its true knowledge, true nature, as knowledge emerging out of conscious identity. And effectivity of action is rather the accompaniment or necessary consequence and no longer masks as the primary fact. Now these sentences are difficult. We shall read them once when we come to this 8th chapter. But immediately for your purposes, Sri Aurobindo distinguishes between instinct and intuition. Both are actually the same. When intuition manifests itself in life, it is instinct. When intuition manifests itself in something higher in you, it is intuition. It is luminous. It is light principle. In the lower, it manifests mainly as activity, as action. Awareness is very subordinate. In the intuition proper, knowledge or light is predominant. Action is subordinate. Basically the same force. If you put it below your carpet, it is instinct. If you put it above your carpet, it is intuition. The carpet is only reason. So what we call reason is nothing but our carpet. Above the carpet is intuitive light. Below the carpet is instinctive light. In between is the carpet. That is what we call reason. So now Sri Aurobindo wants to prove the theme on all the three levels. Instinctively proved, rationally proved, intuitively proved. So from all the three accounts, we have complete proof. So Sri Aurobindo says that this eternal paradox and the eternal truth is justified on the level of deliberate reason, on the level of instinct, and also on the level of intuition. So whatever way you try to find out the truth, this is the truth you will find. Alright, so it's complete proof. Not only rational proof, but instinctive proof and intuitional proof. This is one of the important elements of the life divine. Throughout the whole book, Sri Aurobindo will prove whatever he wants to prove on three levels. On the level of deliberate reason, on the level of instinct, on the level of intuition. It's a triple proof all the time. Therefore, the life divine gives you complete satisfaction. All the three elements are satisfied. Rational satisfaction, instinctive satisfaction, intuitional satisfaction. And that is the mark of the truth. When the truth is really true on all the three planes, I think today we should stop here because the other next sentence will take a long time. So don't worry about our slow movement, but at every stage you find there is so much to study and it is justified if we stop from time to time and not burden ourselves too much at the one single dose. So we shall read again what we have read so far. Thus the eternal paradox and eternal truth of a divine life in an animal body. Have you got page number 4? Thus the eternal paradox and eternal truth of a divine life in an animal body, an immortal aspiration or reality inhabiting a mortal tenement, a single and universal consciousness representing itself in limited minds and divided egos, a transcendent, indefinable, timeless and spaceless being who alone renders time and space and cosmos possible. And in all these, the higher truths, realizable by the lower term, justify themselves to the deliberate reason as well as to the persistent instinct or intuition. Alright, this is the conclusion. What follows is only peripheral now. The whole chapter is now completed basically. What was to be proved has been proved. Now the last sentences are only a kind of comments. Having proved all this, now a few comments are given. So we shall do that next time. That is on Monday now. Alright.